I believe there are two things that change the world. One is stories and one is technology. When I write and read a lot, I find that I'm just naturally happy. Get your reader to ask themselves a question that creates a curiosity gap and you'll keep them around. Promise, progress, payoff. What is your 3% different that you can apply to whatever you're doing to make it stand out, to make it unique? The instant feedback loop of the internet can be a negative to unique creative work.
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. My guest today is Nathan Baugh. Nathan writes fiction in the World Builders newsletter. We talk about writing, nonfiction versus fiction, storytelling and world-building devices, Kurt Vonnegut and other authors, and more. Please enjoy.
What is kind of the origin story around using writing, and why were you initially pulled towards that, and why have you kept with it as opposed to moving into other mediums of self-expression?
I never enjoyed movies as much as books. Not a big movie guy. That surprises a lot of people. There are some that I love, but I'm always drawn to books instead. And I think that has translated just to what I create naturally. Not super comfortable on video. Don't love putting together animations or graphics. Like, I am a horrible artist, straight up terrible. My drawings, you do not want to see them. But I always had this, I've always been pulled towards writing for a bunch of different reasons. When I write and read a lot, I find that I'm just naturally happy. And when I'm not doing those things, I find that I'm naturally not happy. And writing, I break it into two buckets. One is short form nonfiction, which is what you'll see from me on the internet. And one is long form fiction, which is what I want to build a career upon. And for me, there's a really nice flywheel between them. On the internet, short form nonfiction really hits. You can get really, really good at it and understand like what does quality look like there and how do you get eyeballs on it. And then long form fiction is so, so different. But I actually would argue that the skill sets are more tied together than most people would think initially. And that's where I would have really built a career.
What are those skill sets that you think people mistakenly believe are different, but there's actually a lot of alignment around? I mean, obviously, aside from writing itself, but what are the other adjacent ones or like to dig down within writing the aspects of that that are consistent across the two formats?
Yeah. There's this idea called open loops, and it sounds confusing. All it says is if you can ask a question, get your reader to ask themselves a question based on what you have written, that creates a curiosity gap and you'll keep them around until you close that gap. You can close those loops quickly. You can take a while to close those loops, different tricks and stuff to it. And all writing is built upon that idea. If I can write an essay that makes somebody question something in the first three sentences, that's the same thing as writing, a first scene in fiction that makes somebody ask a bunch of questions and want to know what happens later in that story too. Exact same idea.
I was just reading your latest newsletter before we jumped on, because I didn't incorporate it. It wasn't published at the point at which I had started preparing questions. So I was seeing if you had any new material to work with. And I saw you post about this idea of loops. As you mentioned a few minutes ago, you occupy this really interesting space between short form nonfiction and long form fiction, where when I look at a lot of other people who are creating, take David Perel, for example, or who was on the podcast a long time ago, or I just recorded with Billy Oppenheimer a couple of days ago. Both of them are doing more of the short form and long form nonfiction, I think. And for you, it seems like your process is to focus on the fiction, and then use kind of the residue, the learnings, the sawdust that comes from it to incorporate into your short form newsletter. How did you talk about kind of the progression from wherever you started within writing to getting to this place where you're like, I want to do fiction as my thing, but the learnings from it, I want to share in this other form factor?
I would be lying to you if I said that was like the strategy from the start.
Right.
Absolutely not.
It's usually the case.
And will it work? Yeah. Will it work? Who knows? In my head, it made sense, but in reality, we'll see what happens. So I wrote my, or finished writing my first book 2020, roughly. I think middle 2020, like COVID had just hit, or like right before COVID, so early 2020. Started writing that in college. I got super into the fiction world. What does it look like to build compelling characters, to figure out plot arcs, your emotional arcs of your characters, how do you show external conflict as well as internal conflict? All these ideas fascinated me. And I thought I had wrote a decent book, and it got a ton of rejections from literary agents. Like, okay, like very fun, very cool. Like, how do I not go through that process again? Taking 2 years to write something and it never getting to go out in the world. You could argue I could self-publish at the time, had zero audience, zero way of getting any kind of eyeballs on it. So it's not super viable, in my opinion. Fast forward a little bit. A friend of mine, I'm at their rehearsal dinner, of all things, and I'm sitting next to his younger sister, and she's like, Nathan, like, your book was good. You like writing. Have you looked at Twitter at all? And I'm like, Taylor, no. Twitter, like, I haven't seen that since high school. Nobody uses Twitter. What are you talking about? She said, you should try it. Cause I've been trying this like author Instagram page. And like I talked about, I'm a horrible artist, like absolutely atrocious, trying to put together these graphics and stuff. And it was just so bad. So I started trying on Twitter, got lucky with timing where it was, where Twitter was starting to pick up steam. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You had people blowing up on there. I got lucky, had some support from some people who had grown before me. Sahil Bloom, Joe Pompliano, some just great guys who supported my work when they had no reason to do so. So I try to shout them out whenever I can. And that helped get the ball rolling a little bit, your first 1,000, your first 5,000 followers. And then from there, it's consistency, getting better at the craft, all that stuff. When I started talking about storytelling, I would look at it from all these different angles. I would do breakdowns of what different people are doing in speeches or in whatever may have it. And I just found myself naturally drawn towards authors. Okay. What does Neil Gaiman do? What is his writing process? What does he say about storytelling? Stephen King, Toni Morrison, all these people. So over time, just so that consistency, I figured out what I want my lane to be, if you will. And it hopefully creates a nice little flywheel with the writing the fiction, learning about storytelling from that, applying it there. Another way I look at this is it's very important to be unique. Like your name of your podcast, Audience of One. I think that's really, really good name. Because you want to do something that only you can do. And that's super hard to find, actually. So I have a background in engineering and consulting, but also doing the writing. That's a little bit rare. A lot of people who talk about storytelling, they just mean marketing. And that makes me want to beat myself in the head with a hammer when I hear most marketers talk about storytelling. There are a few that do it well, not many. So if I didn't come at this from a totally different angle and talking about it from the lens of fiction writing, that's pretty unique for the online space.
How would you differentiate storytelling, and you also use the other word world building, which I've come to appreciate over the last year or two. I think it applies to a lot more than just writing. It's startups as well. This concept of like building a place where your users can come into and live even without you there. So I think that's a very powerful notion, but I think to your point, a lot of people conflate those ideas with marketing, which feels a little more, gamey, I suppose, in some cases, even scammy. How would you differentiate those two? And what is it about storytelling and world building that you want to get across that you can't do through the lens of marketing?
Totally. I think you can apply them to marketing for sure. But I think, marketing in my mind would be a subset of those skill sets and not the other way around. For example, when I ran a content agency for a while until October, so 3 months ago, we would tell stories of founders, things like that. That's one way to look at it. But in general, if I'm talking about storytelling, what I'm thinking is how do I package up a feeling, an idea into a story and communicate that from my brain to somebody else's brain? That's what I mean with storytelling. That's so broad. It can mean I'm talking about a personal story. It can mean, I'm writing this book and I just want you to sit down and enjoy reading it and not feel like you wasted your time. Like, how do I do that? And the answer to me is storytelling. When I'm thinking about world building, when it applies to fiction, I'm thinking more of setting, or Harry Potter is a great example. There are so many little words that she just added in there that are not real, but they are now because she made them. Muggle, who knew what that was until you read Harry Potter? Okay, that's a great example. All the different spells, things like that, they're so unique. And there's this idea from Virgil Abloh, actually, who, incredible designer. And he has this 3% rule where you can take anything and you make it 3% different, then it's unique. And that's, in a way, how I think about world building. Like, what is your 3% different that you can apply to whatever you're doing to make it stand out, to make it unique? That, to me, is world building.
Yeah, the 3% rule in particular, I hadn't heard that before. That's brilliant. There's often this conversation that creators have, creators again, in the broadest sense, about how do I do something original, often just naturally we're remixing what came before. So I think this 3% rule is like, that is your white space, your latitude for net new creation. But it's always iterating on what was there before. And in fact, you don't have to create something 100% new for it to feel different. Like, there's still people in Harry Potter. They're still walking around. But the whole world and kind of lexicon around magic is really what differentiates it.
And
that's brilliant.
I would argue that the structure that she uses in the first 6 books around, it's a school year. That is no different than what you did in 8th grade versus what I did in 8th grade. So many other people. That structure gives us a sense of relatability to it. Like, we know how school years work. You start, your classes start, you have midterms, you have finals, you have homework, you have all this stuff. And she includes all that. And that's so relatable. But then she changes enough that it is completely different as well. And I think there's like a super nice balance to strive for there between what is relatable, what are we used to, and what is just completely off the walls different.
That's excellent. So maybe dipping into your work for a second, one of the things as I was researching and reading your work that surprised me is I couldn't find your fiction, your books out there. And I don't know if that was intentional. You've done it under a pseudonym, or you haven't actually published them. But first, and then I want to kind of get back to applying that 3% lens to maybe something you're working on. But why have you been so public about the process of writing fiction? And again, maybe it was a failure on my part just to find the work, but haven't been as public about the work you're actually doing.
It is very intentional. So the publishing industry is weird, we'll say. If you start with self-publishing, then that, like the sales numbers and success of there is often used as publishing houses to correlate or estimate what you might be able to sell through them. So there's a big decision to be made whether you go self-publish or go traditionally publish. There's lots of arguments for both. With the current book that I'm writing, I'm going to explore the traditionally published route and use the audience and newsletter as the way to differentiate myself in the sense of, look, I can bring a lot of value to the marketing channels here, basically, and we'll see how that goes. But that's why I haven't self-published anything. My goal is to really, I think, very intentionally build a career around writing fiction. And some people will disagree. I still think that traditionally published route, depending on a few things, first being size of the advance that you get from a publishing house. An advance is exactly what it sounds like. It's like a company gives you a bonus, publishing house gives you an advance when they acquire the rights to your currently unpublished book that they will then help you take over the finish line and then publish. I think there's a lot of value there still. And you're not tied to traditionally published. Brandon Sanderson, I love him as an example, has done traditionally published for the first 15, 20 years of his career. And now he is venturing into self-published or even starting his own publishing house. That to me is a very compelling career route. So that's why you can't find anything for me. So I'm not doing self-published right now.
And so none of the books you've written so far have even been published through a traditional publisher yet. You're nope. Sitting on those and okay. Got it.
So it's usually a 2 to 3 year process from when you get a book deal to when it comes out for fiction. And so a difference between fiction and nonfiction. Fiction, you have to write the entire manuscript and have it in a pretty good spot. Unless you're an established author, you can't just sell a book deal on an idea. You have to have the manuscript, the 75 to 150,000 words. They gotta be done, ready to go. You'd feel decent about them on a shelf. With nonfiction, you can go to these places or agents with just your idea. First, maybe 2 to 5 chapters and a marketing plan, and you can get a deal. Which one of those is better? I would argue nonfiction. Seems like it saves everybody a lot of time. But it is what it is. So you're following the fiction route. Yeah.
One of the key differences between somebody who's kind of forced to go the traditional publishing route versus you is audience ownership or direct to audience access. And of course, you've built your audience, you could argue, in a different kind of niche than you would want it to be for rolling out your fiction to, because it's more writing advice. And yet you still have on the order of 250,000 followers. Why is it that you don't think going the self-publishing route is the right move? Is it that you don't have the correct audience for this, even though the size is there? Or is it just all
That's
the supporting infrastructure?
Something I've thought about doing, and Zach Pogrob, who you have interviewed, is pushing me to do this, is to publish some of my short fiction just on Twitter and see what happens. you know, because if it hits really well, then okay, it is the right audience. If it doesn't as much, then yeah, there's a point to that. I think that's a pretty compelling idea, and I'm probably going to do it. I actually am working on something. It's about this. So there's a story in Greek mythology of how fire came to humans, and it's through Prometheus stealing it from the gods. And I'm turning that into just like a short story. The trick there is keeping it below 10,000 characters. So if it's on Twitter, we'll see if that happens. I think I'm much better at long form fiction than I am at short fiction. They're super different. So yeah, very much thinking about that. And I think it's a compelling idea. The other thing is with self-published books, it's easier to monetize early, if that makes sense. So you get 85 to 90% of all your sales instead of 15 to 20% through traditional. Mm-hmm. I'm not totally focused on making money through the books. The newsletter and the agency and stuff are probably for the next at least 3 to 5 years will be better monetization tools than books for me. What I'm really focused on is how do I get my stuff into as many hands as possible? And I still think traditionally published is the way to do that.
Yeah. I have some people to connect you with after that you maybe already know, but are maybe a half step between the two that could be an interesting path for you to explore as well.
Amazing. Thank you.
Yeah, we could explore that offline. I do want to hear more about the fiction that you have written and are writing. If you're open to discussing it a little bit more, what are the kind of categories and maybe the themes or plots as well, if they've been consistent across your three books?
I think categories has been consistent. They're almost all fantasy or have a fantasy bend to them. The current one, I'll give you an example. I love heist. So think Ocean's 11 or Mistborn or something like that. So I wanted to run a heist for a long time. The current one is a heist with a futuristic fantasy spin on it. And I'm pumped about it. I think it's pretty good. I think the conflict is my favorite part, since the world is at this like point where technology has gone too far. And essentially there's a balance between tech and magic, and we're at the far side with technology. And what does it look like when that starts to swing back? And what characters does that give rise to? What conflicts does that give rise to? I think a lot of books kind of avoid combining tech and magic because they don't seem to go together. And I think there's actually only a few books that have done that really well. So that's something that I want to explore.
How much is that inspired by kind of the present state of affairs in reality and real life? Do you feel there's like a, obviously, as far as we know, there's no kind of real thing of magic, but people would argue there is a kind of hidden magic to life. There's an awe to it that maybe you could substitute in for the purposes of trying to draw a connection here. How much is it inspired by present life versus a like complete kind of fantasy? I guess more directly, I'm curious about your orientation towards tech and the direction it's headed.
I believe there are two things that change the world. One is stories and one is technology. And the two are often maybe at odds. But they're the two things that I want to build my career on. Hence why I run a marketing agency and we worked with AI and fintech startups, because those are spaces that I'm very excited about. Also why I write fiction, the story side. So when I think about, you know, what does my ideal career look like, it is somewhere at the intersection of those two things. I do believe that there is AI specifically for the vast majority of people will be a race to the average. I think there is less personality in writing right now. A lot of people on the internet, sometimes myself included, sound the exact same. There's no Joyce, there's no Onigit, there's no, these people who had such distinct styles. I think we see less and less of that with technology advancing. Just scroll Twitter all day, scroll Instagram all day. Everything looks the same. Everything sounds the same. And I think that's sad. So what does it look like if that swings back towards a more individuality? There's an argument that the internet like rewards individuality, but I would disagree in it. No, everything just kind of looks the same. Like, there's a lot of people on Twitter who want to be Danco. There's not a lot of Dancos who start their own thing. Same thing with David Perel, same thing with Westow. All these, you know, big internet creators, they initially find their own thing, and then there's a million copycats. What does it look like to have more of that uniqueness, that individuality? I think tech gets rid of some of that. So yeah, definitely a theme of that to the story.
Right. Yeah, I think AI will 10x, 100x the number of copycats we're going to get because of the barrier to doing so is dramatically lowered. And yet I think we'll see, like if you think about kind of power laws, that top 0.0001% is going to have so much more leverage because they're going to figure out the optimal ways to use AI to have an even more outsized return. So there's kind of this bigger delta that's going to be generated between kind of those who are just doing what's already been done and those who are innovating.
Yeah.
It's my hypothesis.
And I agree more. I'm very much not a writer who's like, don't use AI. It's the worst. It'll suck the soul out of your writing. I don't think that's true at all. I think if you can tell something was written by AI, that means the person behind it did a horrible job of both prompting and editing. So I wouldn't blame AI for that. I think that's just human nature. Take the shortcut.
Yep. Absolutely. I would agree. You mentioned Joyce and Vonnegut. Vonnegut's probably one of my my two favorite fiction writers as well.
Who's the other?
Steinbeck. Which you could argue is he draws a lot on his personal experience and upbringing and like the Central Valley, but it's still fiction at the end of the day. But I'm curious to hear whether within fantasy or generally who the authors are that you've taken the most inspiration from and why.
The first that comes to mind is Neil Gaiman. He's my favorite modern day author. He's able to do so many different things with his writing. It's almost all fiction, but he's done American Gods, Norse mythology, where he takes these concepts of deities or even stories that have been told over and over in the case of Norse mythology and just tells them in his way. And I think that shows the power of storytelling so well, where you can take an old idea or an old story and put your spin on it and it still feels so fresh. Like that to me is a mark of an excellent storyteller, excellent writer. He can also take the idea of a fairy tale and put a modern day spin on it. Stardust is one of my favorite books. It's very short, but it's so compelling. The structure is so compact. There's almost no wasted words, but he still writes in a very poetic, unique way that I admire. So Neil Gaiman would be the first person who comes to mind. I'm trying to think of more recent folks who people might know. Pierce Brown wrote Red Rising. I think it's probably the best sci-fi that's come out in the last decade. Excellent book. He has a very unique writing style where he's very short declarative sentences combined with really long, poetic, almost literary verse. And that combo just juxtaposes so well. And the way he tells that story is wonderful. Those are my two right now for more modern day authors.
I haven't heard of the latter. I'm going to have to check him out. I've been reading a lot of kind of more fantasy and sci-fi lately. So that fits. It's on brand. One of my favorite things that you do is you curate your favorite, I think it's mostly opening sentences from books, but excerpts in general. I would imagine you primarily lean on like your some kind of note-taking system to recall those. But I'd also imagine there's some that once you read them, they were just instantly and forever stuck in your head. Are there any that if somebody comes to you and says, hey, what are those three or five favorite kind of quotes, whether you can recall them verbatim or not, that stick out? Are there ones that come to mind? And I'd be curious why those ones.
Yeah. There's one from C.S. Lewis. And it's the opening line of The Magician's Nephew, which is the first in the Narnia series. And it goes, there was once a boy called Eustace Clarence Shrub, and he almost deserved it. And I love that. I think it's so funny. But it also gives you an idea of what the character's like. Yeah, like, okay, that's a horrible name. And the author's saying he almost deserves it. This dude must be terrible. Going back to open loops, what's so bad about him? Why does he almost deserve that name? And he does that in one line. And I think that is brilliant. C.S. Lewis would also be one of my favorite authors that I think is currently extremely underrated. So that one comes to mind. The second would be the seventh Harry Potter, and it's just one word. Snape says, always, when Dumbledore asks him about why he stayed true and stayed on the good side, if you will. And that one stuck out to me because it was the culmination of such an incredible arc. And that saw him go from hated teacher to Death Eater to killing Dumbledore to, oh, this guy was actually probably the bravest and most unique, interesting character in this entire series. And J.K. Rowling was able to sum that up with one word. That one hit.
Yeah. Very redemptive.
And there's one from Terry Pratchett that I just think is funny. I'm going to mix it up a little bit. But it goes along the lines of people are always telling you to keep an open mind because they want to just shove your brain full of stuff. I can find the exact. But I thought that it's just clever. And Terry Pratchett has
very true.
Has so many one or two liners like that where kind of subvert an expectation or a common trope or whatever. And so I think he's great for those.
Those are great. You've talked a fair amount through your newsletter and on Twitter about, of course, the different devices of storytelling and world building. What is kind of the, if we were to do like an 80-20 analysis on the most important things to remember when we can either frame it as storytelling and world building generally or within fiction in particular, obviously, I'm sure you could list out 100 different tips and tricks and devices, but what do you feel like are the most important things for people to remember? Like, I can maybe lead into this by saying a couple that stick out to me are the hero's journey, which obviously repeats itself through all kind of stories. And two, to get back to Vonnegut, is Vonnegut's kind of idea of the shape of a story. Kind of things are good, things are bad, some kind of reconciliation or something. But would love to hear, hopefully I didn't steal two of them from you, but would love to hear how you think about the 80-20 of storytelling and world building.
Yeah. So I would give you two. The first is the idea of promise, progress, payoff. If you look at any, from what I've found, if you look at any storytelling structure, whether it's 3-act structure, 5-act, hero's journey, story circle, they're all similar. And I think the, you know, for me, the most important thing is you make a promise to your reader. This is one of those open loops. And to Vonnegut, to bring him up, he has a great line. And he says, on the first page, your protagonist needs to want something, even if it's just a glass of water. That is your quote unquote promise. Let's say this character wants some water. Okay, that's a promise. That means a promise to the reader that you're going to watch them go try to get some water. Okay, and then within the next step, progress. It can't be easy. Like, if Spencer wants some water and he just has a glass of water or a water bottle sitting next to him, that's not a story. There's not interesting. There's no conflict. You don't actually have to try to do anything. So this progress step is all about intention and obstacle. Spencer wants water, but he's in the middle of the Sahara Desert and he hasn't had water in 2.5 days. And, you know, he's probably not going to make it too much longer. He just found a tribe of people there who, you know, maybe they have it, maybe they don't, but he's got to go find out. That becomes a story because you have your progress is intention. Spencer needs water, an obstacle, but all these things, and we're going to see what happens. The payoff point that, you know, Spencer can either succeed or fail. He didn't get water or he can't. But you have to kind of close that loop of promise, progress, payoff. Otherwise, your audience is going to be annoyed with you. And you can close these fast. You can close them over the period of an entire book, whatever works. You know, a lot of people will nest them within each other. So you'll have some that are, you know, to get somebody from beginning of book to end of book, and you'll have some that are from chapter 5 to chapter 8. And I actually use this same idea for essays, for Twitter posts, for LinkedIn posts, whatever, as well as for fiction, because it's super flexible. So I like promise, progress, fail. Second one I like is one you brought up from Vonnegut, which is the shapes of stories. And what I think, so for anybody listening, what he does is he says the y-axis is the emotion that the protagonist is going through right now. Are they happy? Are they pissed? Are they terrified? Joyful? The whole gamut. The x-axis is just time. It can be linear, non-linear, whatever, just time progressing through your story. And the core idea is that emotional state should be changing at all times throughout the story. It can be going up and down, and he has all these different shapes to it. They're like man in hole, Cinderella. They're wonderful. There's one of my favorite YouTube videos, maybe we can link it in the show notes, is on Vonnegut, explaining this far better than I ever could.
Yep.
What I pull out of that is, you want your character's inner emotional state to be changing all the time. And usually you want it to be getting worse and worse and worse, maybe right up until the end. And then there's this interesting thing where my friend Robbie Crabtree pointed this out to me. where the, you know, if your y-axis is like happiness, let's say, you start somewhere, whatever. And then at the end, you want to be a little bit higher than you started. And that's where you want like to end the story as a storyteller. And all of Vonnegut's shapes that he draws and explains follow that rule. I think that's pretty great.
Why is it that there's such a predictable pattern? And albeit like the, there are a lot of different shapes within this that Vonnegut shows. It's not one very consistent shape, but it all has this like up and down motion to it. Why is it that we don't have, maybe we do have stories, they just aren't coming to mind immediately, that are just like either down, 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 or up, 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 up. So one example would be like an even worse death of a salesman, if you've read the short story, where instead of it being like a middle of the road person and things decline, it's like somebody is already at the bottom of the barrel and you don't think things could get any worse, but they do continue to decline. Or it's a different version of Wolf of Wall Street, where he's on top of the world making $50 million a year and things just continue to get better. Is it that there's not enough conflict and tension in those? Like we need the roller coaster?
I'd be lying to you if I said I knew the exact reason why.
Sure.
I'll give you my best guess. Stories don't often mimic reality. It is not super interesting to us. Let's say somebody inherits a ton of money and just gets wealthier and wealthier. Good for them. But do I want to watch a movie about that? Do I want to read a book about that? Not really. Somebody inherits a bunch of money, screws it all up, and has to, you know, pull themselves up by their bootstraps from nothing back to, you know, where they were. That's far more compelling because it has that clear and obvious conflict to it, and very powerful conflict both externally, okay, the money thing, and then internally too. What does that do to somebody to go from everything to nothing and have to pull themselves back? What do they go through internally? And I think you don't really get that internal journey if something's just up, 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 up. And if something's just down, 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 you know, there's an idea that it's actually from Neil Gaiman. And he says, you're onto something with the story if you have the audience saying, and what happens next? If it's the same thing over and over, whether it's bad, 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 or good, 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 you know, Spencer reading that or watching that, you know exactly what's coming next. It's right. Either good or it's bad. It's, you know, that same thing that came before. You're not wondering what happened next. So that'd be my guess. You don't have that what happened next aspect to the story.
Yeah. And I said earlier that I think I may have mistakenly said, this is the way that life goes. And so we want to kind of mimic that, kind of borrowing from this idea of life or art imitates life. But in fact, I think that is for most people not the way it goes. Things kind of fluctuate within this very narrow range over life, and then we're dead. And in fact, we want to see these kind of inspirational, wide range of emotion type stories, because that isn't our day-to-day experience, which is a little bit more predictable. So maybe that makes sense. And why we see these kinds of arts and mediums as an escape, as a place to get to, because it is so different from our day-to-day. So we've been talking a bit about kind of this journey you take people on through storytelling. And I think the writer, and in particular, everyone who subscribed to your newsletter, I imagine, not to stereotype them, but they're more so the early stage writer, the individual who's trying to get off the ground. They're going through their own kind of journey and kind of mental processes trying to get their work out the door. What do you hear time and time again to kind of look at the early stages of that journey? What it is that prevents people from writing What are those kind of self-limiting beliefs that people have that once they kind of unlock or dispose of, frees them up to do their work?
That the first thing you write has to be perfect. Anne Lamott has the idea of shitty first drafts. That's so big for me. The first thing I write, whether it's fiction, nonfiction, for Twitter, for newsletter, or for my book, is usually bad. Like, I'll go back and look at it and go, what the heck were you thinking? But when it's on the page, then you can start to shape it. You can change the details that really matter. You can cut the stuff that doesn't matter so that you're more like a sculptor of, okay, now my first draft is this block of marble or block of shit, if you will. How do I get rid of the excess and turn it into something compelling? That's the first one for me. That when I got over that, I was able to get more and more words per day. And that's the number that I looked at, just words per day. Actually, a friend of mine, Nat Eliason, I'm not sure if you've had him on, but he'd be a good, very good interview. He writes 2,000 words per day, and I'm not able to do that. I'm probably closer to 12 to 1,300 on average. And Nat's doing this thing where he's like, okay, I can do 2,000 now pretty, you know, not, maybe not easily, but consistently. He's like, what does it look like if I average 2,100? Is that stay easy? All right, how about 2,200? So I'm starting to implement that into my own workflow and simply tracking your output like that. I have a Excel spreadsheet, day, words, hours, words per hour, location, time. That's it. And I'm looking for themes across it. Do I write quicker in the morning, afternoon, at 3 a.m.? Unfortunately, I write a lot better at like 10 p.m. I get a lot more words per hour. Kind of sucks, but it's true for me. And, you know, I have enough data now to show that. So I think it's embracing the idea of, okay, get the words on the page and then make them good. And then for me also, you know, maybe it's engineering background. I like to track things and just lean into the data.
Yeah. Perfection is the enemy of great. And I've seen, Nat has now created that app, the kind of slimmed down app that he's been using to track his progress as well. If people are interested in trialing that, I know he's looking for people. But that I found in my experience and for all of my friends who want to do something creative, that desire to, there's this concept of the taste gap that's come up on this podcast a few times, but for individuals who feel like they have cultivated a good sense of taste, they see what's good in other people's work. They're hesitant to put out their own work because it's nowhere near that level of quality. And that's part of what holds them back. It's both because they know they're capable of better work, but also because they've seen the masters at work and don't want to put out something that's absolute shit when they're consuming this great work. And so I think you have to understand that it took those folks a lot of bad drafts, a lot of shitty drafts, as you said, to get to the place they're at. And you've got to go through the same motions.
I empathize with that very much.
Yeah. I feel like we kind of brushed up against this during the earlier course of the conversation, but to ask it a bit more directly, why you are kind of towing these lines between the short form nonfiction and the long form fiction, why not just go head on 100% into fiction if that's the thing you want to do? Is it a diversification strategy, a risk mitigation thing? You do derive some kind of enjoyment from the short form. What's the thinking there? Understanding that you came about it a bit more organically, but now the place you're at, why you still do both?
The So I'm much more focused on the fiction than I was 3 months ago. So 3 months ago, I had a conversation with a good friend, and he goes, if the agency does well and everything, what would you do? And I say, okay, I would then write fiction a lot and focus on building out the educational side of his business. He goes, why can't you do that right now? And I'm just, you know, kind of pissed off at him. Like, what do you mean? Why can't I do that right now? This is what I'm doing right now. And I really, you know, marinate on it a little bit longer. I'm like, oh, unfortunately, you're correct. Hopefully he doesn't listen to this and doesn't get a bigger head about it. And so I, at that point, actually started the process of offloading clients from the agency. We set them up with other agencies who do similar work of high quality and have moved on from any kind of agency operations or running, which means less money right now. But I also have a lot more focus and I think fire to do with the fiction. When I started the whole, okay, let's write on the internet thing, I had just quit my job at EY to move to Spain for my wife to get her MBA. I do not recommend other people do this, but I know myself and I work extremely effectively with deadlines and pressure. And if I don't have those things, I tend to procrastinate. So this I see in a similar way where it's okay. Let's say I give myself 6 months to get a really, really good draft of this book. Can I get a book deal by March, by April? The answer with the agency was no. The answer without the agency is maybe. We'll see. I'll try. So I am much more focused on fiction now than I was 3 months ago. And, you know, I'm thinking about posting shorter fiction, seeing what happens. I probably will on Twitter. And then we'll go from there.
I support the idea of sending out some of your shorter work and getting feedback, getting a taste. I think you might be surprised by the number of people who have an appetite for the long form thing. And maybe that becomes the channel for distributing it, as we were talking about earlier. What would you say is your number one fear as a writer? I think there's a, to cut straight to it, I think for a lot of people who want to publish work, they want public work. It's the feedback of the audience. But I think for some people, it's also the, there's an intrinsic sense of whether you put out the right quality. And there's a lot of other answers to this question, yeah. But kind of buying you some time, what would you say is your number one fear as a writer?
Not living up to my own expectations. Yeah, your previous question was around, you know, why not post some fiction on the internet? I think that the instant feedback loop of the internet can be a negative to unique creative work. I think that is why a lot of the posts you'll see look similar. People figure out the formula to virality and do it again and again and again. So there's some hesitancy for me there with posting on the internet, just because I don't know if that instant feedback is actually something that I want. And then I think the intrinsic drive to put out something that is very high quality also slows me down. This is one of the reasons I actually love copy work, because it shows you what great writing feels like. And until I feel like my draft is at that point, and I'd be hesitant to send it out. But at the same time, I'm my own biggest critic. Right. So how do you make those things stick together is something that I'm very much working on.
That's tricky. Yeah. I have the same sense of that, like, contradiction or paradox. You got to put your stuff out there to find out, but also you want to be protective over it and ensure there's high quality before you do that. On the topic of knowing that there's kind of these perverse incentives or incentives you don't want by putting your work out on the internet quickly, kind of that is a, I think that's representative of a larger consideration that you have when publishing on the internet, which is kind of twofold. First is, how do you protect your time and attention and inputs such that you're curating the highest signal kind of information that helps in turn create the best outputs for yourself? While understanding there's, like, you have to be online in order to be getting, like, I would imagine you found a lot of your best material on your newsletter that you used or whatever by being online. How are you trying to strike this balance between leveraging the power of the internet and the speed and breadth of information with also understanding you've got to do a little bit more kind of protective and timeless stuff, like sitting down for 3 hours every morning and writing? Have you found a good balance there? And if so, what are those kind of techniques?
I have two accounts on my computer. One is my full access to everything account, and the other is literally just named writing. And the writing one, I have it set up where if I flip to that, it automatically turns on airplane mode, turns off Wi-Fi, and the only thing I have downloaded is Microsoft Word. There's not a whole lot I can do on that account other than write. And that comes back to the idea of write or do nothing. I am addicted to the internet, so I have to separate the two. Otherwise, distractions, trying to do too many things at once, all that good stuff. And then I look at the numbers and I've written 85 words in an hour, which is worthless. So I literally separate my computer into two accounts. One has internet access and the other doesn't. Also, the way I look at my writing is simply sharing what ideas have helped me, whether it's an idea from somebody else or an idea that I've had through the process of writing. There are very, very, very few people who I will look to for writing advice on anything who started writing on the internet. David Prowl, Nicholas Pohl, Kieran Drew, Amanda Natividad, Wes Cal. It's probably it. It's probably those five. Anybody else who does, like, writing advice or storytelling advice, probably don't follow them. I follow a lot more people about sports or things like that than I do about writing, because I just don't care about what the next newest writing advice is. I do read a lot about writing. The current one I'm reading is called On Writing. It's not the one by Stephen King. That one's much more famous. This one is by C.S. Lewis, and it's a collection of his essays about writing that he wrote during his very long, very successful career. So I'll read more of the timeless advice when it comes to writing and storytelling than I do on the internet. I'm a big believer in the idea that time is a great filter.
That's all excellent advice. I think I'm going to have to set myself up with the two separate accounts as well, because I found when there's kind of this blended environment, you're naturally your natural inclination is go towards the entertainment, low effort type material. So you have to, it's both the routine plus that structure. Well, in closing, I always ask folks the same question, which is to turn it back around on you. What's one question you would leave me and listeners with, whether to think about or act on?
I like to get people to talk about fiction. So I will say, either recently or just in your life in general, is there a work of fiction that has most impacted you? And if so, what do you think about it hit home so well?
Is that rhetorical or for me? I felt a mix of both there.
Oh, that's for you.
Okay. There's two books that always come to mind. I mentioned earlier that Vonnegut and Steinbeck were probably my two in terms of body of work. And obviously I'm not as well read as I would like to be, but have really gravitated towards them. So East of Eden is for me like the book. I started to reread it again, I think last year. Shelved it as I do. I circulate through books a lot. I don't finish a lot of books. So didn't complete the second pass. I think what stuck with me was how he took you through a multi kind of decades long history of this family. That kind of like longitudinal storytelling was really impressive to me. I think the thing that stuck with me the most is his ability to talk about deep philosophical topics, such as like good and evil, which is a recurring theme in his work, through fiction. He'll have these periods where he's talking about the plot and the characters, and then he'll kind of take this time, this aside, this paragraph, to just go really deep on this philosophical topic. So I think, as with all good works, I can't pinpoint like a specific aspect of it, but I will say that I'm certain that work has kind of seeped into my subconscious and affected me. The other one, which I won't get too much into, is Shantaram. I also have read that one, I think going on two times now. Just the depth of the storytelling, the detail, the way in which he holds your attention across hundreds of pages. And I also have listened to it on audiobook, which added a certain layer to it. But those two stick out to me above the rest. I'd be curious to hear your answer.
East of Eden was fantastic. I won't steal your answer, but good choice. You know, recently I would say Foundation by Isaac Asimov. And
I just finished that several months ago. Started the second one.
I think it struck me as an amazing exploration of the cycles that humanity goes through. And he does it in a very weird way. It's almost not tied to specific characters. It jumps around who the protagonist is. It's much more about the idea that there is this foundation, second foundation, that will inevitably rise, and the struggles that it goes through. I thought that was an amazing exploration of humanity.
Yeah, that's a brilliant point I hadn't thought about, which is the, this hopefully shouldn't ruin anything for those who haven't listened or haven't read it, but this notion of psychohistory, this ability to kind of predict the future of humanity as a whole, not like at the individual level, but where we're collectively moving towards, is also, it's kind of this meta point of that is the cycle that he's also, like that is the device through which he's telling the story as well, or the lens through which he's telling it. So it operates on two levels. That's an excellent point. Awesome. Any others that stick out?
Excellent book. Let's see. That one's
not to,
awesome.
Not to force your hand. That's a great answer.
I'm like racing through so many. There are some that I just love for the pure entertainment value and what they sparked in me as a kid, as a teenager. Foundation, more interesting on like a philosophical level. So I'll just give you one for just like pure entertainment. When I was 11 or 12, I sat down to write first book and worked on it for a while. And then I gave it to my mom and my mom's like, Nathan, you just copied Aragon. And she's right. I did. I just like changed some names and there were some dragons in there and it was Aragon. But that book was the first one that made me like, oh, I want to tell stories like this too, because I thought it was fun. I wanted to pick it up and read it like I got home from school, and I wanted to do that instead of playing video games or whatever. So I think that one as well, even though it's not as deep of an answer, but it just sparked that bridge from wanting to read to also wanting to write.
I think in some ways that's a deeper answer. And you were unintentionally using, I've heard a few writers talk about this idea of writing by hand, the work of other folks, to feel what it feels like to write that way, to write something incredible. And you were unintentionally doing that and remixing, adding your 3% on top of that at the same time. So that's awesome and a great kind of conclusion to this. Well, Nathan, thank you so much for your time. This was a blast. And looking forward to releasing this one.
Thanks for having me, Spencer. Really enjoyed it.